and Ziploc that. Right on my waistline is why I kept that strap. I remember nights, I didn't remember nights. I damn near went crazy, I had to get it right. Now I'm your favorite rapper's favorite rapper. Hey, now I'm your favorite trapper. The absolute truth, yeah, no joke. Who me?
Hey guys, Randy here. It's quick news before we get into the show. We had to ditch the Buck Club as a sponsor. Irreconcilable differences, but we've picked one up. This episode is going to be brought to you by Mizzen and Main. I'll get into more of that a little bit later, but now for the show. Today's conversation is with the golf writer Michael Bamberger. His work has appeared in numerous forums and publications, including Golf.com, Golf Magazine, and Sports Illustrated. He's also the author of numerous books, including The Green Road Home, To the Links Land, The Swinger, co-authored with Alan Shipnook, and Men in Green. Our conversation today focuses on this latter work, Men in Green, which was the July selection for the Reading Room Book Club. Whether you've read the book or not, I think you'll find Michael very interesting and illuminating, and I hope you enjoy our conversation. Michael, this book centers around a list that you compiled of 18 people, and you've separated them into 9 living legends and 9 secret legends. For those listeners who may not have had a chance to read the book yet, can you give a bit of context to how you came up with this list?
Well, first of all, it's nice to be with you, and I've only recently, and I'm always behind in these sort of things, become aware of how influential No Laying Up is in the golf community. So I'm delighted to reach a lot of people that I don't know if I've been reaching in the past. So I thank you for having me. The book called Men in Green, and it's an investigation of some of the lives of people. I'm born in 1960 and started getting really interested in golf in the mid-70s. And it's an effort to catch up with some of the heroes from that period. And as you were just indicating, Phil, I've got 2 lists of people that I want to see, legends and secret legends. And the legends would be known to, you know, most of your listeners, including, you know, Jack Nicklaus and Tom Watson and Arnold Palmer and others of that level of fame. And then the secret legends are people that they might not know, like not Butch Harmon, but his kid brother, Bill Harmon, a caddy, a very prominent caddy in the 60s to the 80s, named his nickname was Golf Ball, his real name was Dolphus Hull, and a very close friend of mine, Mike Donald, who traveled with me as we went around and see these people. He's on the Secret Legends list. So there's 9 legends and 9 secret legends, and then it becomes sort of a buddy road trip to catch up with these people and find out what they were thinking about then while they were doing it and what they're doing now and what they think now about what they were doing then.
Is this a list you had been compiling for a while in your head, or was it something that kind of just came to you on a whim?
It did. I guess subconsciously I probably was compiling it for a while, but consciously it came to me all at once. I can tell you exactly when it was. It was the Friday night, possibly the Saturday, but I think the Friday night of the Ryder Cup that was at Medina when Dave Slove was the captain the first time. And I was out for dinner by myself, sometimes after these long days of covering stuff, you just want a little bit of a break, or maybe nobody wanted to eat dinner with me. I can't recall, more like the latter. And I was in one of those restaurants where, you know how they put out the white piece of paper as your tablecloth, and the waiter or waitress writes his or her name upside down and backwards. How they do that, I don't know. Well, and then they give you crayons. Well, I just started writing down names on crayon with crayons, and I had this list of people, and this book would be known only to some listeners. The one I'm about to mention, there's a book called Boys of Summer by a man named Roger Kahn, and it's a book made, it's a tremendous bestseller probably in the 70s, and it made a big impact on me. It's by a former New York baseball writer who covered the Brooklyn Dodgers when Jackie Robinson, Gil Hodges, and Duke Snyder, and Pee Wee Reese, and others were on it. And what he did was years later go back and reconnect with those people and wrote a very moving book about their life in baseball and their life after baseball. And that was very much an inspiration for what I was trying to do as well.
Gotcha. I'm sure a lot of listeners probably aren't that familiar with your background in the game of golf. I was just hoping you could talk about that, you know, not only your introduction to the game, but you actually, you know, were a professional caddy for a time before obviously becoming a golf writer. Can you just, you know, maybe the brief version, fill us in on,
sure,
on your relationship with the game?
I'm very glad to tell it, only because I think it's instructive of something that golf could be doing. My family had no background in golf whatsoever. My parents were both born in Germany, and my dad in 27, my mom in 31, Jewish family living in Hamburg, Germany, and left for this country during the rise of Hitler and Nazism in the beginning of the Nazi period. So they were very fortunate to even get out of Germany when they did and come to the United States. My dad was an engineer at Brookhaven National Lab, Long Island. My mom was a school teacher, and my brother and I were very interested in sports, but golf was not part of it at all. And the reason I'm giving this preamble is because I think this next part is really relevant to this idea of, you know, quote, growing the game in the United States. Mm-hmm. Our gym teacher at the, you know, the middle class junior high school middle school that I went to, was a golf buff, and he brought in irons and plastic mats and wiffle balls into gym class and taught the game. And I don't know if there were 15 kids or 20 kids in this class, but we were hitting balls off the plastic mats toward backboards and trying to get it through the hoop and that sort of thing. And we were introduced to the game. And as everybody knows who's been introduced to the game, some of the people get introduced to the game are going to get hooked. Many are not, but some are. But you've got to be introduced to the game to know whether you've got the disposition or not for it, which, of course, is not everybody. The point being that I don't know why this approach is not more widely promoted by the PGA of America and the USGA and even the PGA Tour is to introduce golf in the public schools. It can be done in a very inexpensive way. And I enjoy telling that story because, one, I think you have applications for literally millions of other people, and two, it changed my life. This dedicated gym teacher, Mr. Greenlee, changed my life because I did get bit by the golf bug, and it's enriched every aspect of my life, professionally and socially and athletically and everything else. So I was very, very fortunate in that regard. Then I did caddy some as a kid at our local golf course, and you know, enjoyed making money like all kids do, and enjoyed being around the adults and seeing how they behave. You can learn a lot by just shutting up and listening and watching and seeing how people interact. So that was very valuable. And then you generously called me professional caddy. I was more like an amateur caddy. I didn't really know what I was doing. I didn't have any particular talent for it. But I went into caddying really as a way to learn something about the professional game, the professional tours, and also to write about it as well. So I was really a caddy on a tourist visa for two stints in 85 on the PGA Tour and then in 91 on the European Tour. But they were very significant periods because I did learn a lot about professional golf, and I think I got to see the game through the eyes of you know, working class professionals, guys, you know, trying to stay on tour. I've always been drawn to those people anyhow.
There's a lot there, and I'd love to ask you about that maybe towards the end of our interview, about the macro state of the game, if you don't mind. Right now, though, kind of diving back into your book specifically, you mentioned Mike Donald as one of your secret legends, and he's also, I think collaborator might be a good word to use, throughout the book. He accompanies you on many of the road trips and is there during many of the interviews. I was just hoping you can kind of give a bit of insight into who Mike is as a man and a golfer,
and also what role he played in writing or editing the book. Did he have any role, you know, aside from being with you on the road?
That's a very insightful question, Phil. And I haven't ever used the word collaborator, but I think that is probably the perfect word. So, how familiar are you with Mike's story, or would you have been before reading the book? Would you have been aware of what he did in the game?
Yeah, in all honesty, before reading the book, no. It was a name right. That it's like, oh yeah, Mike Donald, I kind of know that name, but yeah, unfamiliar.
Right. Some years ago, Mike and I were playing at the Bears Club, Jack Nicklaus's home club in South Florida, and we happened to see Rory McIlroy there, and I've written him some about Rory over the years, so you know I knew him well enough to say hi to him. And I introduced Mike to Rory, and I could see Rory, was in probably just in his early 20s, maybe mid-20s, like kind of knew the name, but that's about it. And so when I subsequently saw him, I said to him, trying to give a shorthand to describe who Mike was in the game, that he was Rocco Mediate before there was a Rocco Mediate. And by that I meant Rocco famously went 92 holes or three holes in that 2008 U.S. Open.
92, I want to say, but don't quote
92.
Me on that.
Okay, so and against Tiger Woods. Well, Mike did much the same. He was in the 1990 U.S. Open at Medina. Hale Irwin posted a score early on Sunday of the U.S. Open, and then Mike, who was about nine holes behind him, about 2 hours behind him, matched that score, and that led to an 18-hole Monday playoff when they still had 18-hole Monday playoffs, and they were still tied after 18 holes. So here's Hale Irwin trying for his third U.S. Open. I think I have that correct, and I'm quite sure that is correct.
Yeah.
And Mike, a journeyman, of course, trying to win his first major. So it was a little bit like what Tiger and Rocco were years later. So Mike was still tied after 18 holes, and then lost on the 19th hole. But Mike played more PGA Tour events than any other player in the 1980s. I believe that's correct. And he made more cuts than any other player in the 1980s. And as Mike humorously and often notes, he also missed more cuts than any other player in the 1980s. But he played week in and week out, and he was a bachelor and he loved the life, and he's a very bright, intuitive person, has a keen understanding of people, and was on the tour policy board, and understood the inner workings of the tour, has tremendous insight into the to player-caddy relationships, player-player relationships, player-golf course relationships, just really one of the smartest people I know. And over the years, in a variety of ways, we've become very close friends. So, yes, he very much became my wingman is really not the right word, although I probably have used that word before. But he accompanied me on these tours, and he really became both the reporting and the writing of the book. He became its secret weapon because, well, for a lot of different reasons, one of which is when Mike and I went to see subjects together, it wasn't just a reporter talking to a subject. It was a tour player who knew both the language of the conversation far better than I, but also the subject knew they couldn't BS Mike because he had been there and he knew what it was all about. So having Mike sitting there with me made it more candid and honest, made the subjects more candid and honest than they would have been otherwise. And, so that changed the whole tenor of the book. I wrote the book, but Mike influenced, it's every page. Okay. So I think when you use the word collaborator, I think, Phil, that's the perfect word.
Okay. Your book, it was published in 2015. I believe I have that correct. Yeah, 2015.
Yeah,
so about 3 years on now, is there an interview or a scene that sticks with you the most?
Yeah, I would say there really is, because when I think about the book, the one that I go back to is the interview with golf ball Dolphus Hall, the African-American caddy from Jackson, Mississippi. that Mike and I saw in a nursing home when he was really on his last legs. And I guess what he had seen so much high-level golf, he caddied for Calvin Peet and many others over the years. And what Mike and I saw was both a tremendous insight into golf and to his own experience in the game and the role that he played in the game and gratitude for it all and an appreciation for where he was then in his life and where he was now and an acceptance of it. Also a lot of insight into the fleeting nature of life. And all this was described much less pretentiously than I just said it. You know, it was described in the most straightforward, honest, man-to-man way you could imagine. But he made that interview probably made the biggest impact on me. I think on many readers as well.
Well, I was going to say, we have a message board. And so when I choose kind of the book of the month, we start a thread on the message board. And just like you said, I think the chapters on golf ball certainly elicited the most reaction. And I think people, and myself included, that was really neat to read about. I think the one little anecdote that sticks with me is about Raymond Floyd and his relationship with Raymond, and specifically, you know, how golf ball talked about Raymond coming to his house and staying the night. And I just love how you say, talking about that story, if golf ball's story was true, it was incredible. If it was not true, but ball believed it, that was something too. I think that was one of my favorite lines from your book.
Well, it's neat that you picked up on that. I mean, it shows you how our mind can play tricks on us and get us to believe the things that we needed and want to believe. But golf ball really believed that Raymond Floyd flew to Jackson, Miss, I think from South Florida in his memory, and came to his home and spent the night and got involved. I think they were celebrating a birthday and golf ball's memory of it. And it may or may not have ever happened. I think it probably didn't happen, because I think had it happened, I think Raymond would have said it happened.
Yeah.
And Raymond didn't say that. But, you know, this is an older man who was, you know, on a lot of medications. I'm sure he was on certain medications at that point. And choosing to believe something that made his life more enriching to him. And, you know, I'm sure we all do that in our own way. At least we create these fantasies that we wish were true, even whether they are or not.
Mm-hmm. Switching gears a little bit, I thought another really interesting nugget from your book. You said writing about Palmer and Nicklaus and some of the other stars of that era was much more meaningful than writing about Tiger Woods has ever been. And I was just curious if you can expand on that thought, if you still believe that to be true, kind of given the second life we're seeing with Tiger now.
I would say I have had, I would say my appreciation for Tiger has increased a lot since 15, or my sense of him has changed, because I think we've all seen the toll that his life and times has taken on his own body and mind. And in 2015, let me think for a minute of where he was in his life then. So he had not won a major since 08, but he won five times in 2013. And, you know, I'd been through, you know, what I often call the stiletto parade period of his life, which, you know, I gave him a wide berth for, because, you know, I've said this many times before, but the only person I think who had that whole period correct was Jack Nicklaus, who said, you know, it's his private life, it's none of my business, which is exactly how I felt about it. But so leaving that all aside, but the general sense I got from Tiger was, you know, he is the Secretariat, Muhammad Ali, Wilt Chamberlain of our sport. In other words, you know, it's the most dominating athlete that we've ever seen, even more so than Nicklaus and Hogan. But, and it's a very big exception, I didn't want to say big, but it's a very big exception that he didn't engender much emotion for me, because I felt he gave little to the public in the way of his interviews and the way of expressing his gratitude for what the game gave him. I felt that he took more, everyone takes from the game, and people give in life the way that they think is appropriate. I didn't get that. I don't know. I just felt we had sort of a one-way relationship with Tiger at that point. I think since then, despite, and I'm not diminishing his greatness in any way. I mean, anyone who follows the game knows what I'm talking about. Winning a U.S. Open by 15, winning a Masters by 12, winning a British Open by 7, winning the Grand Slam, 4 consecutive majors. Just, you know, the dominating record that he achieved. What I think we've seen since I wrote the book is we're starting to see the frailty of the man, the mental frailty, the physical frailty, the fact that he's recognized, as all human beings do eventually, not all, but, you know, virtually all, that to go through this life on an island by yourself, you know, in isolation, is an unsatisfactory, ultimately unfulfilling way to go through life. And I think we've seen that Tiger has found that he needs the camaraderie that comes with the team competition, that without opponents to beat, his record really is meaningless. And the point there is that he's actually part of a community of golfers, you know, that goes back to, you know, young Tom and old Tom, and certainly Hogan and Nicklaus and Palmer and Watson and various others. And he's part of that lineage, and that's a very significant role. My sense is that he has shown more understanding and appreciation for that now than he did when I wrote that in 2015. Boy, was that a long-winded answer.
No, I think that was a good answer.
All right, thank you.
I really liked your comparison of Tiger to Ted Williams, in that each kind of gave up a bit of their humanity. I don't know, for their greatness, but in conjunction with their greatness. And I think it's interesting the change that we're seeing in Tiger.
Yeah, now Tiger is reticent to talk about this, and I can totally understand why. But I have to think that arrest on Memorial Day of 2017, as awful as it was, had to be, I'm guessing, a significant turning point for him, because here's a man who has so much discipline and so much control, and obviously on that night, things were out of control. Mm-hmm. And the chances, you know, it could have been a one-off, but it probably wasn't. And the whole world could see it, and there was no denying it. So everything really, if you're going to continue to go down that path, everything's in jeopardy. And he's too smart and caring a person to let that happen. So I think he's under no obligation to talk about this, of course, but I think there had to be a very significant turning point in his life.
Yeah. I think one of the questions that comes up most, speaking of Tiger in relation to your book, is I think people are curious why he was not included with the living legends.
Well, he wasn't one of the living legends because that was really, I mean, he is a living legend. He's the ultimate living legend, possibly. But I was going for people that were significant to me in the 70s when I was first falling in love with the game, much the way Roger Kahn was going back to the Brooklyn Dodgers of the 50s when he was covering them for the, for the New York Herald Tribune in the 1950s. So, yeah, Tiger would not have qualified by my own definition. But I hope there's some person out there who 20 years from now, when Tiger's, you know, more ready to discuss his own life, will find a way to Tiger. And get him to talk about what it was like to be Tiger at the height of his powers. I mean, that would be great. But that wasn't my goal or role then. He was still in the thick of it.
Gotcha. Guys, Randy here real quick. I mentioned earlier today's episode is brought to you by Mizzen & Main. To be honest, I'm not really sure how this all came about. I suspect Tron was doing some shady backroom dealings
after he wore the shirts up at the BMW Charity Pro-Am in Greenville. Anyway, he told me to do an ad read, so being the friend I am, I complied. What's crazy about it is Tron kind of wore their shirts on a lark, and they ended up actually looking really good on him. And more than that, he said they were actually really comfortable to play golf in. Kind of a, almost like an athletic wear, but it's a dress shirt. So imagine if they're comfortable to play golf in, they're probably comfortable to do just about anything you do in a dress shirt. Anyway, appreciate their support. Check them out if you'd like, MizzenandMaine.com. And now back to the show.
I think obviously one of the big threads throughout your book is Arnold Palmer. And I think maybe lightning rod, I don't know if that's the right word, but a very interesting anecdote is the rules controversy involving Ken Venturi. And just quickly for any listeners, again, who haven't read the book, it's centered around the 1958 Masters, and Arnold Palmer got probably a bad ruling and ended up playing two balls, but there was a question. Ken Venturi maintained that he didn't play his second ball properly, and that's kind of the basis for a rules, like I said, a rules dispute that at least Ken harbored for the rest of his life. I'm curious if you got any blowback or criticism writing about that incident, or you know, if you've had any second thoughts in kind of how you handled that incident.
Oh, no. Now, I mean, I feel very, I don't have any sense at all. I feel very gratified that I was able to delve into it as deeply as I could. It's too detailed and cumbersome to go into every last detail about it. But, Phil, you got the broad strokes exactly correct. Venturi and Arnold were exact contemporaries, and Venturi missed the chance to win the 56 Masters, in which he was competing as an amateur by shooting a last round 80. And then 58 was playing as a professional and was paired with Palmer on Sunday. And Palmer did get a bad ruling and did play the second ball. And some point subsequent to that, Venturi got it in his head that Palmer had not played the second ball in accordance with the rules. It's so cumbersome, but what actually happened was that there was a rule change long after that 58 Masters that changed the definition of how you're supposed to play a second ball under those circumstances. But if you go back to the rule, the only thing you can do is go back to the rule book as it existed in 58 when Palmer played it. And through the good offices of David Fay, the former executive director of the USGA, he provided me with a copy of that that rule book, which I had never thought to do before that. Well, I had never really had the interest or the inclination to go that deep into it. It makes it very plain that Palmer did proceed correctly. So it becomes interesting on so many different levels. But the most significant one is, what was it about Venturi, who's one of my living legends on the list, what was it about Venturi that would not allow him to let go of this incident, and what that said about the Palmer-Venturi relationship, and what it said about Ken and his own view of himself? Here's a man who wound up in the Hall of Fame, had a 35-year career roughly with CBS, won the U.S. Open, and had a tremendously fulfilling career, but couldn't let go of this one thing. And what is it about our nature as human beings that instead of celebrating things that we have accomplished, we dwell and obsess on the things that we don't have? So that's why it becomes a running theme through the book, is to try to understand Ken better through this incident. But along the way, Arnold reveals himself as well, because Arnold, in the moment, Arnold handled it really, I think, very appropriately, because he did get a bad ruling and the rules did allow him to play a second ball. And Bobby Jones, the president of the club at the point, he adjudicated it right there on that Sunday. He was, in effect, the local rules committee, and then the rule book backed up what Palmer did and what Jones did. But Arnold, really, as he did his whole life, he took the high road with Ken. He was confused why Ken. He thought he and Ken had a had a friendship and an understanding of each other, and he was confused as to why Ken was so bitter. But always took the high road and never. And then when Ken died, which happened during the period when I was reporting the book, Arnold really wrote with exceptionally. Just a generous, candid tribute to Venturi as a man and as a golfer, while acknowledging his confusion over why Ken couldn't let this incident go by.
Yeah, I think you kind of lay out a psychological profile of Ken Venturi, which is, like you said, that's kind of what interests me the most and what I enjoy reading and learning about people. And I think your book, you know, both good and bad, it does a really good job of that with Ken. One of your living legends, who I have to admit is more of a secret legend to me, and I imagine probably a secret legend to a lot of people, and some of that's based on how she chose to live her life after her golf career, is Mickey Wright.
Well, that's well said. She, you know, it's really funny. I don't know if we wrote this in the book or not. I couldn't decide myself whether she was a living legend or a secret legend. She is a living legend, but since nobody really knows anything about her, that makes her more of a secret legend. So, I've written about Mickey Wright a lot over the years, and I've talked to her on the phone for hours, and we've had a great email correspondence, and I've never met her. And when I've gently suggested that maybe I could possibly meet her, she has very politely suggested that that will never happen. So, so she's very much both. And this is a woman, as far as I know, I'm pretty sure this is correct. The USGA at its museum and library in Far Hills, they have rooms devoted to the life and times of Palmer, definitely, Nicklaus, Hogan, and Mickey Wright. I think that's it. Mickey Wright would not attend the opening of the Mickey Wright room at the USGA headquarters in Far Hills because she just did not like that kind of attention. So, now, it would be very easy to describe her as a recluse, and many have, and I probably have, but she's really not a recluse. She goes about her life in a semi-public way, as we all do, and you know, going to the post office, wherever it might be. It's not like she's a, some kind of shut-in. She's the opposite of that. But as she says of her own life, golf was a big part of it for a certain number of years, and she moved on, and she didn't want to get dragged back into it. And I mean, it's an extraordinary person, extraordinary in the sense that it's so uncommon, that could just sort of shut the door like that. But she did. So I consider myself extremely fortunate that she was willing to even talk to me on the phone and share with me things from her life and her golfing life.
Yeah, I was going to ask if your relationship had evolved to where, you know, you had met her, but you answered that question.
No, I haven't. No, it would be an honor to, but it's been an honor to get to know her on her terms as well. And for listeners who don't know this, if you want to see about the most beautiful golf swing you've ever seen in your life, just YouTube Mickey Wright. Hogan once said of her, you know, the best one I ever saw, man or woman. And it evolved over the years. I've seen tapes of her early in her career at the height of her powers, but it's rhythmic, powerful, totally on plane. Turn, and it's just one turn back and one turn through. And it's sort of like Byron Nelson meets Ernie Els, you might say, but it's more than that. It's her own thing. It's simple and powerful. It's an extraordinary swing, and it's an extraordinary life that she led.
I know exactly what I'm going to do when I hang up with you after this interview. I am for sure going to look that up.
Just one quick final note about Mickey Wright. She's, of course, in the Hall of Fame, and anyone who's been to the Hall of Fame knows this, like each player who's in the Hall of Fame has a, or each person who's inducted into the Hall of Fame has his or own, her, his or her own locker. And Palmer's has cardigan sweaters and putters and drivers and bottles of wine. It's, you know, as I've written before, you know, there's enough stuff in there for a yard sale. Well, Mickey Wright has exactly one thing in her locker, at the Hall of Fame in St. Augustine. And it's a copy of her book called Play Golf the Right Way by Mickey Wright. And, you know, that's sort of typical of her understated approach to everything.
Gosh, that is very interesting. Mike, if you don't mind, just a few more questions. Is that all right?
No, okay. It's fine. I'm enjoying it.
Okay. All right. I think a lot of your stories and a lot of your characters are, you know, for instance, Billy Harmon, you know, Mike Donald getting his start, Raymond Floyd, Lee Trevino. There's so many good stories, even when Arnold Palmer was starting out and going around in a trailer with his wife Winnie from tour stop to tour stop back in the 50s. The tour was different, obviously, back then. My question to you is, do you think the tour is as good now as it was then? Does it produce as many interesting people and interesting stories? Or is that something where, you know, the people that lived through the heyday and kind of came of age at certain times just fondly remember certain periods more so than other?
Right. Good question. People are always prejudiced in favor of the period when they were at the peak of their powers in any walk of life, whether it's politics or sports or the arts or the plumbing business. Whatever it might be, it was always better then. So now I'm very attached to that 70s period, you know, because way beyond Palmer's still playing at a high level, and Nicklaus and Watson and Crenshaw. We also have Lanny Watkins and Hubert Green and David Graham and Hale Irwin and Jerry Payton, and on you could go about the players and their character. How their character got revealed through the kind of golf that they played. So I've got a romantic going to that. And I know that there are people, teenagers and people in their 20s, who will have that same exact feeling that I have for Jordan and Justin and Dustin and Justin. And if you can keep all those names, you know, going in your head, you know, you're far quicker than I, but, you know, and that's human nature, and that's great. But
I was going to say there has to be a but.
The tour was a tour in the 70s, and it was a community of golfers that did sort of go around this country together and try to beat each other's brains out week after week and did it with a certain amount of character, I would say, that one does not see as prominently today, I don't think. Now, as a starting point to that discussion, they called the PGA Tour with a capital T. But in actual fact, it's not really a tour. It used to be a tour because, you know, you went up and down the California coast, then you went up and down the Florida coast, and you went to the Deep South, moved your way up, you know, into the Middle Atlantic states and then to New England. Little dips into up into the Midwest, etc. The point being was that you could actually chart it out on a map and you'd see a tour. Now guys, you know, they drop in and drop out as it suits them. So you don't have that communal bond nearly the degree that you did. Having said that, when you hear about Jordan Spieth and Justin Thomas and Kevin Kisner and others all staying together in that same house at Carnoustie, well, that tells you that that there still is you know, some strong strengths of both competition and camaraderie among the players. And so there's probably more of it than I realize, but I'm not as emotionally attached to it as I was when I was a teenager in the 70s, first falling in love with the game for the first time. You know, just as a quick nod along those same lines, but I always find this very interesting. You can talk to anybody from any walk of life, you know, no matter how much they've achieved or not achieved in their life. If they caddied as a kid, it is amazing the detail that they can tell you about who they caddied for, how they were paid, how they were treated, because it's, you know, just the nature of young love, really. So I think that's the thing that we're getting at here.
Yeah. Yeah. More broadly, you had mentioned kind of your introduction to the game through school. Do you think, kind of drawing on your wisdom and experience just being around the tour and the game of golf at large, do you think that golf is in a good place right now? And I think maybe my question is, can we separate the tour from that? It just seems like, I don't know, me personally, there's so much money in the tour. I don't know if it's... I don't know if sustainable is the right word that comes to mind. I'm just not sure kind of what the future of the tour holds. And I'm equally not sure kind of that relationship with golf at large. I was just curious kind of your take on the game at large and the tour maybe more specifically.
Well, interesting question. I'll make no claim for wisdom. I'll make some claim for experience just because I've been around the game for a while. I would say I would urge you not to be worried. And the reason I would say that is because golf has always been a fringe sport. And just to go back to my gym class, you know, let's say if 20 people were introduced to it in that gym class, the game stuck with maybe two or three of us. But that's the nature of the game. It's time-consuming. It's difficult. So low learning curve. It's frustrating. It's time consuming. It can be expensive. It doesn't have to be as expensive as people often say. But golf should be, I think, comfortable with the fact that it is essentially a fringe sport. You know, in the mid-1980s, Jack Nicklaus, you know, who we all think of as the icon of icons, he was obscure enough on the national stage that he could do an ad for American Express where the bit was, "Do you know me?" And they would show pictures of Jack and he would describe his accomplishments. And then at the end, it would show J.W. Nicklaus on his American Express card. But the point is, nobody knew who he was and nobody knows who Justin Thomas is. Now, he's very well known in golf, but outside of golf, nobody could identify this guy, really. And that's fine. That's just sort of the nature of our game. So, you know, the things that are the controversies of the day, does the ball go too far? Are the courses too short? These discussions have been going on forever. And the game has always, but in the game in the end has always been the thing that it was, which is a really peculiarly contemplative game by which that stationary ball sits there and you imply your mind to get your body to do something that it can do, but it may or may not do at that moment. And that's true whether your name is Jordan Spieth or Phil or Michael or some kid who hasn't even played the game yet. That part of the game will not change and has not changed. And those challenges remain what they've always been. And it will always appeal to some people, but not to many. And that's okay. So the idea of quote, growing the game or not growing the game, it's very important for the industry of golf. But I'm not particularly concerned about the industry of golf. I'm concerned about covering the game for those who have found their way to the game at whatever level they play. It doesn't matter. So I tend to be less worried than others about it. Now, having said that, because I think it's a great, beautiful game that will improve, you know, various aspects, if not every aspect of your life, I would love to see more people given the opportunity to be introduced to the game. That's a necessary starting point. Give the opportunity to people to be introduced to the game. That, I think, is a very significant thing. And that's something I think that all of us, each in our own way, can find a way to play a role, whether it's introducing a friend or a child or somebody else to the game and seeing if it sticks. Because if it does stick, you're going to find a way to have a social life and an athletic life and learn decorum. And you know, you and I both know the whole long list of how the game can enrich your life. So that would be my long-winded answer to your good question.
Yeah, the phrase "grow the game" kind of always makes me roll my eyes. And as you were talking and kind of as I was reflecting on how you were introduced to the game, it almost seems like a better tagline should be to seed the game of golf. Where,
yeah, that's beautiful. You know, that's very well said. No, maybe. That really is. Just give people a chance. You know, now just to take this conversation one more nuanced level, I mean, as a white middle-aged man, I would love to go to golf courses and see a much broader community of golfers than I see. And I say that because it's a great game and it's improved my life and I think it improved the lives of other people. So I think that as a starting point for quote growing the game, or to use your phrase, seeding the game, I think that is very significant. And I know there's a lot of efforts, but sometimes these efforts, they're so earnest, even though they're so well-meaning, they're so earnest as to be, they've zapped the fun out of it, really.
Yeah, it seems a bit contrived a lot of times.
It does seem a bit contrived. I would totally agree with that.
Well, it's interesting, as you just said that, and tying it kind of back into your book, I thought it was very curious in your chapter about Sandy Tatum, one of your secret legends. He wrote the piece, projecting what the, I believe, 2045 U.S.
Right.
Open field might look
about
like.
Transgender golfers being in the field. And
Yeah. And very curious that the USGA, I believe it was the USGA, spiked it.
They did.
From their program in 2012.
They couldn't handle the truth. They couldn't handle his version. They couldn't handle his vision of what the future might look like.
Yeah, that was a bit of a head scratcher. That was interesting.
Yeah, it was.
You've been very generous with your time, Michael. If you would allow, this is kind of how I like to end each interview. I have it's kind of a two-part question, and I think I know one of the answers to one of the parts of your questions because he's a secret legend. But I was going to ask you who your favorite golf writers, authors are. And perhaps some of the people that have influenced you. And then also, it can be golf or otherwise. Are you reading anything interesting at the moment?
Well, that's good. Is there a golf writer on the Secret Legends list?
Well, Jaime Diaz.
Oh, of course, Jaime. Yes, you know, he's so much a friend of mine that I it doesn't immediately come to mind. But of course, Jaime. Jaime's the best person in golf. For those who don't know Jaime Diaz, Jaime's been a reporter and writer at Sports Illustrated, the New York Times, Golf Digest for long stints, and within the past couple of years has made a move, a full-time move to Golf Channel, where he's doing analysis now. He writes with so much insight and so much heart and so much compassion. When I think of Jaime, the first thing I think of is him as a friend, which is why I was actually flummoxed there for a second so you answered my question. This is a writer on the list. But now, of course, he's, quote, more of probably a TV person than a writer.
Sure.
But he made his bones in golf, playing the game at a pretty high level and writing about the game with tremendous insight. And some of your listeners wouldn't know this, but the Hank Haney book about Tiger, The Big Miss, which I regard as probably the most insightful book about Tiger by significant margin that there is, was ghostwritten by Jaime. And I would say it would have been a much, much lesser book in the hands of any other writer. What I'm trying to say is that Hank was very wise to choose Jaime as the ghostwriter. Jaime's been covering Tigers since he was a teenager, maybe before that even. But anyway, so yes, when I'm with Jaime and we're talking about golf, I'm always learning something about the game from Jaime. And by that I mean, you know, the golfer and how the golfer thinks about the game, you know, whether it's Johnny Miller or, you know, his father, the golfer, or himself, or his own insights into my game, whatever it might be. So Jaime is certainly one. When I was a kid, would you be familiar with the name Herbert Warren Wind?
Yes, I've mainly through other people is how I'm familiar
right.
with them.
Well, Herb Wind's, you know, was a long time golf writer for Sports Illustrated and for the New Yorker magazine, and I read him as a kid and wrote with tremendous passion, but even more than that, just a deep, deep understanding and knowledge of the game, and also played at a high level like Jaime, and you know, not a super high level, but you know, good enough to have played in competitive golf at a high level as an amateur. And anyway, I got to know Herb late in his life, and that had a profound impact on me. Some of the readers, some of the listeners would know the name Roger Angel, who's written about baseball for the New Yorker, is now in his mid-late 90s, actually. But Herb Wynn covered golf much the way Roger Angel covered baseball. Jenkins, I find myself going to something called the SI Vault on the internet and reading old Jan Jenkins stories from the 60s and 70s and 80s and just marveling at how easy he makes it look, and sort of the casual way that he describes the golfers he's known, often on a very intimate level. And then I read a lot outside of golf, which I know is not what you're asking me about here.
I'm personally curious if there are any, you know, if you have a favorite author, if you really have, you know, it's hard to say a favorite book, but one that you've read recently that kind of sticks with you.
Well, I mean, I'm reading one right now that it's not even out yet. It'll be out in a little bit. It's called The Library Book by Susan Orlean, who wrote The Orchid Thief. That was turned to a movie called Adaptation. It's about her love of libraries, and it's about the great Los Angeles Central Library fire that I think was maybe in the late 80s that she's investigating the nature of the fire and what caused it. Like all my favorite nonfiction writing, there's an element of detective work to it. Detective work in terms of understanding her own passion for books and libraries, and also this actual fire and what caused it and the crime behind it. So I find that very satisfying. I just read a memoir of a writer named a guitarist named Jorma Kaukonen, who was a guitarist for Jefferson Airplane and the founder of a band called Hot Tuna. Someone I've been listening to for, you know, 40 or so years, just wrote a memoir about his life and times in music. He would be an example of the secret legend. He's noted actually in the book, as a secret legend. In other words, many people would know the name Grace Flick from Jefferson Airplane, but many fewer would know the name Jorma Kaukonen from Jefferson Airplane. A few years ago, a book, this is probably my favorite, if you can call it sports writing, I don't know that you can, but probably my favorite sports books one of them anyway, that I've ever read is one called Barbarian Days by the writer William Finnegan, writing about his life in surfing. That book won a Pulitzer Prize. It took me a whole summer to read because I'm a slow, careful reader, and also because I was savoring every word of it. So, yeah, I'm lucky to have the hobby. You know, my main hobbies are going to the movies, reading, and playing golf, and, you know, getting in the ocean when I can. So I'm lucky to have those hobbies that have sustained me for a long time now.
Yeah, that's not bad. That sounds like the life. Well, hey, I will wrap it there, Michael. I think, gosh, I didn't even really get a chance to ask you about Billy Harmon and Neil Oxman. There's so many good characters in your book.
I'll give you one quick note about Billy Harmon. I once asked him, Billy Harmon would be the study of a lifetime for any writer. He's so insightful into people. But here's one comment about Billy from his years of teaching. I said to Billy, you know, what's the thing that interests you most about golf and golfers? That's not precisely it, but riffing along those lines. And he said, the ball in the air. Now, Jaime subsequently told me that others have also said that, but first time I ever heard it, maybe the only time I ever heard it was from Billy Harmon. But the ball in the air says so much because one, as an instructor, that ball's in the air. You can tell what the golfer is doing, and then you can work around that. But two, that ball in the air is filled with mystery because that ball's in the air, and you don't know really what it's going to do. You know, it could ricochet off a clubhouse roof and go into a hole for a hole in one. That's happened many times. It could take a bad bounce and take a good bounce like Tiger on the 54th hole in that Open Championship at Carnoustie and stay in play when it could have gone into that burn and change everything. Take a bad bounce and go out of bounds. So that ball in the air, it's just, I love the phrase because there's so much mystery in it. But anyway, next time we'll talk about Neil Oxman and various other things that you might be interested in. And I really appreciate you having me.
No, thank you. I certainly hope the next time is sooner than later. Thank you so much, Michael.
You take care. Bye.
All right. Bye.
Max is the spot for that trap draw.
Ziploc that, right on my waistline is why I kept that strap. I remember nights, I didn't remember nights. I damn near went crazy, I had to get it right. Now I'm your favorite rapper's favorite rapper. Hey, now I'm your favorite trapper's favorite trapper. The absolute truth, yeah, no joke. Who